On this Labor Day, what we get for our work and what we're not getting, and what that label Made in America really means. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In New York, I'm Lizzie O'Leary, in for Kai Rizdahl. It is Monday, the first day of September, Labor Day, and it is great to have you here. And this being a federal holiday and all, hopefully most of you are not working. But since it's Labor Day, we thought it would be a good time to check in on how much most American workers are getting paid for their labor these days. The answer? Not a whole lot more than they were three decades ago, relatively speaking. That's according to a new study of census data from the Economic Policy Institute. From our Wealth and Poverty Desk, Marketplace's Chrissy Clark has more.
When Jamad Reed started his job as a cashier at a Walmart near Cincinnati,
I was making $8.15 an hour.
That was 2 years ago. But since then, he told me he's gotten a couple raises. Congratulations.
Thanks, I guess.
If you detect a slight lack of enthusiasm there, that's because those raises have been pretty small. They've kept up with inflation, but just barely. As of March of this year, Reed started making $9.05 an hour.
I'm stuck. You know what I'm saying? I feel like I'm stuck in the same spot.
Stuck is a pretty good word to describe wages for most American workers over the last few decades, not just in the case of lower-wage workers like Reed, but along much of the income spectrum, except the 1%, of course. Elise Gould is with the Economic Policy Institute.
If we look at wages at the very top of the wage distribution, those with the most education and the highest wages, and the median worker as well.
On average, Gould says wages for all these workers have seen little to no growth since the late 1970s, if you adjust for inflation. That's not to say individual workers haven't seen gains, but
as productivity has continued to rise, workers' wages, typical workers' wages, simply have not.
A half century ago, in the first few decades after World War II, back then, as the nation's productivity grew, so did wages. So what happened?
This is like one of the questions that people are arguing about right now.
Linda Barrington runs the Institute of Compensation Studies at Cornell University.
Is this about the loss of bargaining power and workers aren't able to regain these productivity gains, perhaps in the way they could when labor unions were stronger?
Or, Barrington wonders, have shareholder returns just become more important to business strategy?
As opposed to sharing the returns and the gains to all of the employee base.
Whatever the reasons, Barrington says stagnating wages don't just affect individual wallets, because don't forget,
every worker is also a consumer.
And consumers are what drive the modern American economy. I'm Chrissy Clark for Marketplace.
Since it's quiet around here today, I've been doing a little online shopping in my downtime. And poking around on the internet, I wound up on the Walmart website where I noticed they were touting products made in the USA. And also made in the USA with imported parts. Marketplace's Adrian Hill checked out what those labels really mean.
Let's start things off with a little Demi Lovato. Who knows, just like retailers out there, there is something fundamentally appealing about products, love, whatever.
Made in America is a very important consideration for many Americans.
Michelle Amazine is a professor of advertising at Rider University. There's a perception, she says, that things made here are better quality, and that buying them will help keep jobs in the country.
It is a very powerful label.
But if you want to put it on your product, you better mean it. Julia Solomon Inzor is an attorney with the FTC, which has a riveting 37-page document outlining the standard.
If a marketer wants to make an unqualified made in the USA or other U.S. origin claim, then the marketer needs to have substantiation that that product is actually all or virtually all made in the USA.
That means a lovely lamp that is assembled in the U.S. with American-made brass, an American lampshade, but an imported base doesn't count. Bonnie Patton heads truthinadvertising.org.
A lot of companies try and wordsmith their way around the law, for sure.
Like designed in the USA, made with U.S. labor. Made in the USA with imported parts. So, Lizzie, if you want something truly, fully made in the USA, you're going to need to read those patriotic labels real closely. I'm Adrienne Hill for Marketplace.
No trading on Wall Street today. U.S. markets were closed for the holiday, but we'll have some of what's happening overseas when we do the numbers. Let's say you see an old car driving down the road. Maybe a 1957 Chevy? Now imagine every person who's ever owned it. Earl Swift did more than that. He took one 57 Chevy station wagon and traced its history from brand new family car through a dozen different owners to the man who ended up restoring and saving it. Earl wrote a book about it. It's called Autobiography, a classic car, an outlaw motorhead, and 57 years of the American dream. Earl Swift, welcome to Marketplace.
Thank you, Lizzie.
I would say your book has two main characters, a man and a car. And I guess I'd like you to tell me when you first met each of them.
Well, I met the human main character, a gentleman named Tommy Arney, in 1993 when he was running a go-go bar in Norfolk, Virginia. And I went to the go-go bar as a reporter for the Virginian Pilot newspaper in Norfolk to interview him about a constitutional battle that he had become embroiled in with the state over an alcoholic beverage control board regulation that said that he couldn't sell hard liquor in the presence of a woman's exposed midriff or buttocks. And, 11 years after that, I decided, having driven a succession of beaters in college and throughout my 20s, and wondering often back in those days what the cars had been like when they were new and actually functioned as intended, I decided it might be an interesting newspaper story to find an old car and try to trace it back through everybody who had owned it and try to tell a bigger story, something about America or about the region or the state.
The subtitle of your book calls this 57 Years of the American Dream. How does that apply, I guess, both to the 57 Chevy, but then also to a guy like Tommy Arney?
Well, the interesting thing about a 57 Chevy station wagon specifically is that when this car was new, it wasn't viewed as the frumpy grandpa mobile that station wagons became in the 60s, 70s, and 80s. A station wagon in 1957 was a real status symbol in the same way that an upper-end SUV would be today. I mean, this was a car that advertised to everybody that you had achieved a piece of the American dream, that piece being that you had made it into the suburbs. After a couple of back-to-back wars, after the worst housing shortage in American history, and what you find is as the car ages, the relationship of its successive owners to that dream, to their connectedness to it, starts occupying an ever wider orbit. You know, they grow more and more marginalized from it.
Tommy Arney clearly loves restoring cars, but I think also seems kind of torn in his own ability to do that, held back. And you see him battle that throughout your book. What's going on there? Is there some inability to move forward?
To finish the job?
Yeah.
I think that he enjoys savoring the process. He's also the product of a restoration himself. And perhaps he recognizes that when you restore something old, you lose something in the process. I mean, there's a beauty in age that's erased when you take a car that shows every mile it's traveled and you slap on new metal, new paint, and you erase its blemishes.
Earl Swift is the author of Autobiography, A Classic Car, An Outlaw Motorhead, and 57 Years of the American Dream. Thanks so much for talking with us.
Oh, thank you so much.
Think about a city with 500,000 people. Now, double that population overnight. That happens every August in Edinburgh, Scotland, when a dozen different festivals come to town. The city earns more than $400 million from the dozen or so festivals, but it's the Fringe Festival that's probably the most well-known. Bill Lance adds up its economic footprint for us.
Spectators stand shoulder to shoulder along the Royal Mile as it snakes its way down from Edinburgh Castle to Holyrood Palace. Street performers from all corners of the world vie for just a bit of your attention.
It's 3,000 different shows, all of which run pretty much every day for 25 days. If you went to see every show, it would take you 3 months.
And that's assuming you don't take time to eat or sleep. According to Neil McKinnon, the Fringe Society's head of external affairs, it just keeps growing.
This year, we are 10% bigger than we were last year.
Edinburgh is packed in August. Buses take twice as long, temporary helped wanted signs hang in store windows, and once comfortable pubs don't even have room to stand. T-shirt screen printer Norm Richardson tells me he's been buried with orders.
August is a nightmare, to be honest. As early as you can get in to as late as you can be bothered working. Days and days and days stretching into the future, like the end of Raiders of the Lost Ark, where there's just boxes going off into infinity.
The festival supplies 15 to 20% of his yearly volume. Cat Brogan of Mercat Tours says it's hard to keep a tour group's attention with so many other things going on.
We get clever. So we nip down wee streets and closes and alleyways to make sure that the guides can be seen and heard.
Some hotels have been completely booked since January.
And their prices go up exponentially as well.
Neil McKinnon from the Fringe Society says accommodations are hard to come by, but the people who live here have found a way to cash in on the problem.
There is a long tradition of thousands of Edinburgh residents vacating the city for the month of August. They rent out their flats, which are occupied for the month.
Some apartments require tenants to move out for the month of August. Fringe University's Andrew Jones says some students he helps place are charged 3 months' rent for their one-month stay.
Edinburgh in August brings out the Adam Smith and everyone.
He means Adam Smith, the father of capitalism, who might be proud of his hometown today, but one group that's left out of the windfall? The artists who perform. Jones recalls a conversation he had with a theater company at the festival.
We've got a budget of $120,000, and we plan to make about $20,000 back in the box office.
While businesses profit from the festival, Neil McKinnon says theater companies generally don't.
Most companies will either break even or not make a profit. They are here because it is an investment in their career.
A long-term investment that might never pay off. Screen printer Norm Richardson is skeptical about the likelihood of being discovered.
It's just a bit harder now to get people to kind of notice you because everyone's fire-eating and juggling on a unicycle. So how do you choose which unicycling fire-eater to go and see when there's so many?
Undaunted, the festival continues to grow as each year more artists come to chase their dreams here in the Scottish capital. In Edinburgh, I'm Bill Lance for Marketplace.
Coming up, when the thrill of owning your own business gets messy.
He said, go back, get ready. Your first summer is about to kick off. Go buy some equipment because you're going to make this stuff faster. So that's exactly what I did, like an idiot.
But first, let's do the numbers. U.S. markets were closed for the Labor Day holiday, but there was still plenty of action in Europe and Asia. Markets there were mixed, as news that a breakthrough in Ukraine might be in the offing was offset by concerns about China's manufacturing growth. Traders and investors in Europe speculated whether the European Central Bank will decide to keep stimulating the economy there. Britain's FTSE 100 and Germany's DAX both marched up 0.1%, while the CAC 40 in France traded flat to slightly lower. Tokyo's Nikkei added 0.3%. You're listening to Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at what's coming up Tuesday. On this day, 1945, Japanese troops formally surrendered to Americans and victory was celebrated in the States. In 1969, America's first ATM made its public debut in New York. And it's time to set some goals, folks. It's National Self-Improvement Month. I'm Daisy Palacios.
This is Marketplace. I'm Lizzie O'Leary, in for Kai Rizdahl. Apple has an event pretty much every year or so where the company rolls out what they want you, and media everywhere, to believe is the next big thing. This year's no different. There's the iWatch, something called an iWallet, and probably some other iThings. But this is also Apple operating in a more competitive environment than it's ever faced before. Marketplace's Queen of Kim reports on what happens if Apple can't deliver.
Steve Jobs used to have a catchphrase to describe new Apple devices. He'd call them insanely great. But 3 years after his death, consumers and investors are asking, will Apple keep churning out products that hit that mark? Charles Byers is a marketing professor at Santa Clara University.
Some of those expectations may be close to phantasmagorical.
Anticipation for the new iWatch, for example, is hitting fever pitch. The blogosphere is expecting it to do everything from open your garage door to becoming your new mobile doctor. Trip Chowdhury is an analyst at Global Equities Research, and he says Apple just needs to ignore all that noise. When it comes to the smartwatch or any new product, he says Apple needs to focus on what it does best.
Apple just has to go back to its roots. What do they do? Less is more. Make it so easy that anybody can use it. Your grandma could use it.
Chowdhury says there are already a lot of smartwatches with plenty of bells and whistles out there, but they're difficult to use, and mostly it's tech geeks who are into them. He says Apple's magic is in taking existing technology and making it intuitive, simple, and universally desirable. James McQuivey is an analyst at Forrester, and he says if Apple doesn't introduce a breakthrough product soon, the chatter that it's lost its mojo will grow even louder.
And honestly, if they can't do something momentous by the end of 2014...
McQuivey says investors will conclude that Apple's days of being an insanely great company are behind them. In San Francisco, I'm Queenie Kim for Marketplace.
We've got another story about cars today. The Italian car company Fiat has had a troubled history here in the U.S. In the late 80s, it gained a reputation for poor quality and reliability. But now Fiat's doing pretty well for itself. It rescued Chrysler from bankruptcy 2 years ago, and now it's trying to bring one of its sportier cars to the U.S., the Alfa Romeo, which, as the BBC's Russell Padmore reports, might be an uphill battle.
Alfa Romeo's 8C could be the model that reinforces the return of its parent Fiat to the American market. Paul Eisenstein is the publisher of the Detroit Bureau.
Chrysler is now the more successful side of the company, and it seems like the Fiat management is more and more leaning towards being an American company. This company left the United States in a cloud, and they have to hope that they can overcome the bad memories and go to people who like the idea of a truly sexy, sporty Italian vehicle.
Alfa Romeo, I'll be your Alfa, Alfa Romeo.
Success in the U.S. for Alfa Romeo will depend on a network of dealers and people like Silvana Gula, whose family-run business, Fiat of Larchmont, has been selling Italian cars in New York since the 1960s.
Alfa Romeo does have that racing prestige. It is perceived, and it is a bit more upscale than the Fiat. So we are going to be more competitive with people that are buying in the luxury, sporty segment, such as BMW or Audi.
Fiat's control of Chrysler could eventually make the company serious rivals to Ford or Toyota, and it's transforming the fortunes of the Italian car maker.
That's the BBC's Russell Padmore. A lot of small businesses start with a great idea, the kind that wakes you up in the middle of the night, it's so good. That's what Jim Picariello thought he had when he invented Frosties, basically frozen tea popsicles. And if there is one thing that everyone in his world agreed on, it was that his idea was a really good one. But in the world of business, a great idea sometimes isn't good enough. Here's Amanda Aronchik.
Jim Picariello and Jill Day moved to Blue Hill, Maine in 2000 for the same reason that lots of people move to Maine. It's beautiful, it's remote, and after a year of decompressing, Jim was ready to start something new.
I've got to come up with some idea. I got to start a new company. I got to do something interesting, and I didn't know what it was.
For years, Jim had been making himself too much green tea, sweetened with honey. So he'd pour the leftover drink into those molds that you put in the freezer to make popsicles. Then he has an epiphany. Frozen tea popsicles. This is it, he thinks. This is my business idea. But it isn't the only project Jim has got going. He has a 2.5-year-old girl, and his wife is pregnant with baby number 2.
So I said, I think the timing is terrible.
Jill, Jim's wife, says he could try to start a business anyway. And very quickly, Jim raises $25,000 to test out recipes. And that is when Wiseacre Inc. is born.
When I said go ahead, I really didn't feel like we were starting a business. And I think that's probably one of the reasons why it even happened, is that I wasn't really aware that that's what we were doing.
Jim, he sees the future. He starts entertaining grandiose visions of where this could all go. And he pictures himself going to Expo East, the natural food conference.
You know, I'm going to go there and I'm going to be a rock star and everyone's going to be freaking out and going, this is the best thing I ever had. And I'm going to walk out of there with contracts and be on top of the world. And that's what happened.
Not only does Jim win Most Innovative Product for 2007, but he also gets a big-time distribution deal. All of a sudden, he goes from making his tea popsicles and tiny saucepans in his kitchen to needing his own factory and employees. He hires a dozen locals, but they're more used to throwing fish in a bag than making a high-quality product. So Jim says, time for a field trip.
They all rolled their eyes and said, okay. And then the next morning, I had a 15-person passenger van, and we drove to Portland, Maine. And I took them into a Whole Foods, which none of them had ever seen. In fact, some of them had never been to Portland.
It's only a 3-hour drive, but it's the big city, and it's a world away.
So you walk in there, and it's this cavernous, beautiful store where everything is shiny and neat and well-arranged. The produce is stacked in pyramids. There are walls, literally walls, of greens and peppers. And then we turned the corner to the frozen section, and somebody literally stepped in front of us, opened up the freezer door, and grabbed a giant handful of our product and walked off with it. They were like, oh, did you see that? And they were all so proud that their product was purchased in a store that they didn't even know existed, you know, hours before. And then I explained to them, that's what's going on in the whole East Coast right now.
For a while, his teapops are in about 800 stores, but not enough people are actually buying the popsicles. Jim needs some marketing. He needs advertising. And what he really needs is money.
So we got one local billionaire who is semi-famous around here for investing in local stuff.
And his finance guy calls Jim in for a meeting.
And he was like, listen, I'm the manager on this side. We're in for $1 million. He shook our hand. He said, go back, get ready. Your first summer is about to kick off. Go buy some equipment because you're going to make this stuff faster. So that's exactly what I did, like an idiot.
He buys a blast freezer, a new label maker, a ton of boxes.
This is going to be huge.
2 weeks go by, and Jim is really set up for mass popsicle production. But the check from the billionaire hasn't arrived yet.
Turns out a couple of days after our meeting, the billionaire tasted our product and said, oh, I can't imagine why kids would like these. And of course, it's not a product for kids, it's a product for adults, and kids do like them.
The billionaire backs out of the agreement.
And so at this point, I'm sort of doing the math in my head over and over. I have this much money, we have this much payroll, we have this much rent, we have this much electricity, all that over and over and over again.
So I do remember he did ask me if he could start putting payroll on our credit card, our personal credit card.
It was just like, I now have no more money. I have to lay all you people off. And it was very sad.
The bank seizes the equipment and the factory closes. Jim has to declare bankruptcy of somewhere around $500,000, and the debts he owes go unpaid.
Do you remember what that felt like?
Well, we're still dealing with the ramifications, so it's still hard, especially because we moved up here to have a more simple life and specifically to not be in debt and to have the kind of significant debt now that we have because of the business tanking is just like the worst thing that could have happened.
I went forward and made some financial decisions. You know, I did on a handshake, which you'd think you could do, but you just can't. And I knew better, but I was starting to feel desperate.
After Wiseacre and Jim went bankrupt, it took a year for him to find a steady job. He's now working as an instructional designer at a local college. He and Jill are still paying off the almost $50,000 that was on Jill's personal credit card.
I don't know. Would you guys do this again? Would you try again with a business?
I would never put our family in jeopardy in the same way. But at the same time, I would never say never either.
The last time I heard from Jim, he said he did have another crazy product idea, but swears that this one would be far less risky. I'm Amanda Aronchik for Marketplace.
This final note on the show today, if you remember Augustus Gloop, Veruca Salt, Willy Wonka, and of course our hero Charlie Bucket from Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, then I have some good news for you. No, not a golden ticket. A lost chapter of Roald Dahl's classic book has been published by the English paper The Guardian. In the lost chapter, the children go into the chocolate factory's vanilla fudge room and its rather violent cutting and pounding room. Not all the kids make it out. You can also catch glimpses of some early character sketches and Dahl's trademark dark humor. The paper says it was deemed too wild and subversive 50 years ago. All right, that's it. That's Marketplace from American Public Media. Our daily production team includes Bridget Bodner, Tommy Andres, and Daisy Palacios. I'm Lizzie O'Leary. Kai Rizdahl's back tomorrow. Shout out to anyone else working on Labor Day. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.